Your Radio, Hampshire College.
Hey folks, welcome to North American Psychotherapy. I'm your host, Henry Epp. This is the fourth of five themed episodes that I am producing as part of my Division 3 project at Hampshire College. The first episode's theme was home. The second and third were about rebellion, which leads us to tonight's theme, wanderlust. When I first plotted out the themes and orders of these episodes back in the fall, I saw sort of a coming-of-age narrative arc linking each of the episodes. We started at home, comfortable, at least in theory, and contained. At some point, we leave home as it becomes too restricting. We rebel. In rebelling, we feel fearless, invincible. But once the rebellion's been done, where do we go? The answer's never entirely clear. So, still full of fearlessness, we go. We wander. We push, or get pushed, past our boundaries, without putting much thought into the consequences of our actions. Which leads us to tonight's theme, rebellion. So here we go, let's wander. Outside here at Hampshire, I'm walking through the snow in Hampshire's backwoods. There was a nice coating of snow the other night, and it's definitely a early March kind of feel out here. Sticky snow and some mud, and still a lot of fallen branches from the big snowstorm we got back in October. But it looks good out here. It looks nice. I'm just wandering. Don't really know where I'm going. I usually feel compelled to relate these episodes' themes to my own life. And on the last episode, you might have heard how I talked about how I've never been much of a rebel. But I have wandered a bit, or I've been put in wandering situations. Almost every summer of my childhood, my family would take a 5 or 6 week road trip. We'd have a general destination, usually extended family or friends on one of the coasts and a few national parks or tourist spots along the way. But there are also many long days of driving out in some place like Wyoming or Nevada, where we'd only pass through a few small towns in the course of 8 hours or so. And as the sun set, my sisters and I would ask our parents where we were staying that night. And they would give us a vague answer, usually, oh, you know, a drive-in or campground or a motel or something. And then some time would pass and we'd ask again and get the same non-specific answers. And if we persisted, sometimes we'd finally get the honest truth. We don't know where we're staying tonight. And that was that. Those evenings would usually end with us setting up our tents by flashlight or falling onto starchy sheets in a cheap motel. And more than a few times, we'd pull into a rest stop at dusk and put on our pajamas and lay out blankets and pillows in the back seat to the low tones of Mom and Dad having adult-sounding conversations as they drove through the night. And I think that's why I've rarely felt any hesitation to wander aimlessly sometimes, like I'm doing right now. And clearly, should do more often and sound a little out of shape. But listening to me walk around aimlessly, it won't make a great hour of radio. So, to start off, here's a poem by my very good friend, Georgie Delgado, about a bit of wandering that he did a few years back. So stick around. I'm going to keep walking.
Gloucester, Massachusetts, September 3rd, 2010. Jacques and I left Vermont in a daze. We were in desperate and violent need of a new section of sky to burn through. We drove 8 miles over the speed limit, ignored a hurricane threat, imagined ourselves larger than nature. When the rain first began to fall, his voice shifted. It became more like an old baseball bat and less like the bark of a young dog, even though the water didn't last long. The shower broke before we had stopped driving. When we finally pulled alongside Kathy's house, we cheered our good fortune, and 4 hours later we sat in the kitchen with Andrew, each of us drinking deep from Scarlett O'Hara's blood. That night, all of the laughter that resonated through the house was enough to make me want to trace the word rejoice onto my windpipe, onto every night I've had stolen from me in the last 2 months, onto my still recovering heart. The next morning, the four of us drove to the beach and clambered onto rocks the size of small cars. We jumped along them, each claiming one at a time for our own private country. I pretended to push Jacques in the ocean and we all laughed, while maybe 10 feet away, Kathy photographed us, the light striking everyone golden. I started thinking, so this is us. This is youth. And I looked out at the ocean again. And I laughed. I felt bigger than I'd ever felt before.
Grand adventure. I was always looking for some journey. All my friends were going off and doing really cool things, like building earth huts in Spain, and I was like, I want to do that. I want to go. So I had applied for some internships and some abroad stuff, and it all fell through. And then finally, towards the end of the summer, I got the opportunity to go out west and to go to this festival in the desert called Burning Man, and it's this art festival. Yeah, and I was like, cool, this is it. This is my journey. This is going to be totally, you know, transforming and whatever. It's going to be awesome. So I bought a plane ticket, and I flew out there to Reno, and I don't know if you guys have ever been to Reno, but I don't know. So I got there, and I met these two 50-year-old women at the airport who I'd never met before, and we decided to get a hotel room together and then to get a van and drive out into the desert the next day. So we ended up staying at this hotel called Circus Circus, and it was like if Hunter S. Thompson and John Wayne Gacy had a hotel franchise together. It was awful. It was absolutely terrible. There was lots of clown faces and gambling and illicit street drugs, and I was like, what am I doing here? This isn't for me. So anyway, I'm in the hotel room with these two 50-year-old women, and they're showing me their sparkly leotards, and one of them's like, rub my bald head, and I was like, what am I doing? This isn't my journey. This isn't for me. But anyway, I get in the van, and the next day I get to Burning Man. We have to drive like 3 hours into the desert, and I get there, and I get out of the van, and at the gates of Burning Man, there are these greeters who greet you. So I hop out of the van, and I'm met by this man who is wearing a leather thong, and he's shirtless, and he comes, and he gives me this big hug, and I'm around his tits and his sweat, and I'm like, awesome. And he says, welcome home, sister, welcome home. And I'm thinking, this isn't my house, this is weird. I don't want to be here, I don't want to be here. But anyway, I figure, let's go with the flow. Like, this is Burning Man, I'm supposed to do it, so let's go, woo. So I go out there, and I'm hanging out, and everything is very, very grand. I mean, people spend thousands of dollars to bring out roller derbies and bars on stilts, and it's very elaborate. And I was looking around, and I thought, this is very self-indulgent, and people are walking around in costumes with fake names, and yeah, it seemed very grandiose, and I thought, you know, I have a space like this. I go to Hampshire, you know, I have that already. I don't need this. I can call myself whatever I want and pee all over whatever non-gendered bathroom I want to, you know. I have that. I don't need that. I was thinking, this isn't my journey. This isn't my journey. That's not what I'm here for. But anyway, I hung in there, and I was experiencing it, going with the flow, and I ended up meeting this group of artists and playwrights and musicians, and I ended up camping with them, and we became very close very quickly in that setting, and it was awesome. We were workshopping work, and we were having these intimate one-on-one conversations, and I thought, this is it. This is my journey. This is what I was supposed to figure out. So midway through the week, one of the people we were staying with got a phone call from home that one of their good friends had committed suicide. And so now we're all in this together, and we're trying to support them emotionally and help them out, but it was a very surreal place to be mourning. I mean, they're crying, and there's fireworks going off, and people are coming by our campsite, and they're like, you want to go to the dildo trapeze? And it's like, not right now, hawk feather, it's not a good time, come on. So it was weird, but we ended up going to this place called the Temple, which was created for reflection and meditation. So we went there, and as we're standing there, I was with a girl, and she was there with her brother, and she's crying, and she's mourning, and her brother's holding her, and he's holding her a lot, and just letting her cry, and I was absolutely floored. You know, I have a brother that I have absolutely no relationship. He won't hug me. He's scared of my armpit hair. He won't come near me, and so it was kind of like, wow, you know, here they are, and he's really opening himself to his sister like this, and I thought it was great. So afterwards, after they separated, I went up, and I said that to him. I said, you know, I noticed the way that you were hugging your sister, and I thought it was awesome, and I wish my brother would do that for me. So then he went ahead and hugged me, and I cried, and it was probably for way too long than any of us was comfortable for, and whatever. But afterwards, I just sort of realized, I figured that's what we're all looking for, is just some sort of compassion or empathy from any sort of stranger. You know, so I don't know if that was going home or anything, but it just kind of made me realize that if you can step to whatever conversation you have with anyone and bring that compassion, whether it be a hug or something way weirder, you know, that's what it's all about. So thank you.
That was a story by Hampshire third year Aaron Ferrantino, told at the Broth Story Slam last semester. The Broth is a live storytelling showcase that I helped organize along with Remy Schwartz, Nara Williams, and Ben Yellen. We're having another show on March 29th at Food for Thought Books in Amherst. If you're in the area, you should definitely come check it out and tell a story of your own. And before Aaron, we heard Georgie Delgado, a fellow Hampshire Div 3 and friend of mine, reading his poem Gloucester, Massachusetts. So I'm still out here in the woods, and it's kind of chilly today. These trails are really familiar to me, or most of them are, but there's one up ahead that I don't think I've ever been on, so I'm going to go check it out. In the meantime, I'd like to share some of the fiction writing I've been working on that makes up the bulk of my Division 3. The story you're about to hear is called Crisis in September, or at least that's what I'm calling it right now. The story follows a young man in his first few weeks of college on the way back home for a funeral. What you're about to hear is the first 10 or so pages of the 23-page story. So if you want to hear the rest, you'll have to tune into future episodes. But this is how the story starts. So enjoy. Ooh, that looks cool up there. I'm going to go check it out. Thank you. She disappeared in Gary, Indiana, like the classic rabbit in the hat trick. One moment she was there, and the next she wasn't. When the bus broke down in Portage earlier that afternoon, she'd scavenged her bags from the lower storage compartments, tossed them to the side of the road, and signaled for me to come over. That was about halfway through my 30-hour trip from Massachusetts to Minneapolis. I could feel my hair clinging to the sides of my head from hours of sweat and stale bus air, and tried hard not to think about how gross it must have looked. She stood in the middle of a 5-foot radius of belongings, some of them hers, some not. This included my own small black duffel stuffed with a change of clothes, a book I intended to read but knew I wouldn't, an iPod, a lighter, a toothbrush, and a comb. Forgetting deodorant bothered me, but seeing as how she'd voluntarily sat next to me for several hours, and even struck up a conversation, it didn't seem to be an issue. She had similarly strewn her bags around in search of her ticket when she first boarded the bus in Toledo. From the long line of disgruntled travelers, she emerged under two thick overcoats, several backpacks, shoulder bags, a duffel, and purses, with two rolling suitcases in tow. I watched her yell to the impatient bus driver as she searched for her ticket through the baggage that steadily descended from her shoulders to the pavement. When she finally emerged, the driver cursed under his breath as he threw her things into the luggage compartment. Passengers frowned and avoided eye contact when she boarded. Then she saw the seat next to me. I guess I didn't frown hard enough. She was quiet until we reached the interstate. "Where are you going?" she said, staring at me with eyes wide enough to expose the whites all the way around her brown irises. She had brown hair that fell to her shoulders with clumps and strands sticking out in all directions, covering her clear-skinned face and thin lips. Beneath her open coats she wore form-fitting pants tucked into heavy brown boots and a tattered black T-shirt, with holes exposing a corner of her bra. I caught myself staring and turned away. I told her I was headed to Minneapolis, and she asked why. I said it was my home, and I'm in school in Massachusetts, and I had to go back for a funeral. "I'm sorry to hear that," she said, but her face didn't show it, just kept staring intently. Was it sudden? Unexpected? She may as well have been asking what type of milk I drink. "No," I said, "it was brain cancer, so it was a pretty long time coming." "Oh," she said, and turned forward, then snapped back suddenly. "Speaking of Massachusetts, Ted Kennedy has brain cancer." "I know," I said. "It's the same kind my aunt had." "That's too bad," she said. "I bet they'll do a lot more research now that an important person has it." I remembered my mom's reaction the day the news of Kennedy's cancer broke. She was sad, but not for the Kennedys. Mostly just added grief for our family's situation. The Kennedys would be fine. She asked if I had a lighter. I said yes, but it was with my bag in the storage compartment. "Besides," I told her, "you can't smoke on the bus." "I know," she said, then whispered, "but maybe I could turn off the smoke alarm in the bathroom thingy in the back." "That's not a very good idea," I said, and turned to the window. "Okay, well, you got any nicotine gum?" I tell her no. "Well, then I'm just fucked, aren't I?" she said in a raised voice. She was starting to annoy me. "I don't know what to tell you," I said. I'm not much for bus talk. She pulled down the mini tray table from the back of the seat in front of her and started drumming her fingers on it. I asked where she was going. "My ticket's to Minneapolis, too, but I'm trying to get up to Winnipeg." She turned back to drumming. I looked closer at her face. She didn't look much older than me, but as she frowned, I saw lines on her cheeks that could put her well over 30. Later she told me she was 26, which made sense given her behavior, but not her aging skin. "Wait," she said. "Do you think you could get me a ride to Winnipeg from Minneapolis?" "No, I don't think so." "Come on, man," she said. "You gotta know someone with a car." "I know people with cars, but no one who'd want to drive a stranger to Winnipeg." She slunk back into her seat, still drumming. The drumming grew louder, beyond her fingers, until the whole bus was shaking. Sleeping passengers looked up as the rumbling grew, then a thunk, and our side of the bus dropped a few feet. Metal on concrete squealed from below, and the bus pulled onto the wide shoulder and skidded to a halt. A collective groan rose through the bus as the driver stated the obvious, "We've got a flat," and told us to hang tight. He left. She decided to leave too. She wasn't the only one. After a few minutes of mumbling, a few passengers left to stretch, smoke, and check their phones. I joined them, and as soon as I stepped outside, she was next to me. "I need your help," she said, grabbing my arm and pulling me to the side of the bus. She pointed to a key held close to her coat pocket and told me it opened the luggage compartment and that she had stolen it off the driver's keychain as he talked to AAA or the bus company, whoever was in charge of dealing with this kind of situation. She said to watch her back, and with no excuse not to, I stood guard, looking out over the flat stench of northern Indiana as she lifted up the compartment door and began tossing bags to the pavement. When everything was taken care of, she picked up what was hers. I grabbed my bag, too, since she had thrown it out. And when she asked if I could get her two rolling suitcases for her, I said, "Sure." "Follow me," she said, and started walking up the road. I barely had time to adjust my bag over my shoulder before she was several yards away, beckoning me past the smokers and phone checkers. I ran to catch up. "What are you doing?" I asked. It's not like me to just get up and follow a stranger, and I had a feeling that she was someone not worth following. "I'm going, man," she said, and kept walking. I stopped. "Where? I can't go with you. I need to get back on this bus." I could hear the childishness of my voice. "I need to get home." "What do you mean? Your home is this way. Come on." "How did she expect to get all the way to Minneapolis from here?" I asked. "By walking and hitchhiking and probably hopping a train, you pussy. Come on, let's go. It'll be fun." I'd seen this movie before, I thought. Eccentric but intriguing woman swoops in to save an anxiety-prone young man, pushing him out of his comfort zone while somehow conveniently fulfilling all of his intellectual and romantic desires. I wasn't having it. Too cliché, and movie endings usually don't pan out in real life. So I'd be more likely to end up alone in a ditch than find all my hopes and dreams fulfilled by an eccentric. "Have fun," I said. "I'm getting back on the bus." I put down her suitcases and walked back. She shrugged and stuck out a thumb to the road. The door to the bus was still ajar, and a few other passengers had boarded, so I headed back to my seat and drifted to sleep with my bag in my lap. My dreams got strange. In one, I was already back home, getting off the bus and meeting my mom in downtown Minneapolis. She was happy to see me, but we had to pick up a strange piece of furniture before we could go home. When we arrived at home, my aunt was there waiting for us. She looked healthy, with all of her hair and a big, cancerless smile. But there was a problem. She couldn't talk. My mom said that's what the furniture piece was for, so we hauled it out of the car. It was a sort of combination chair and shelf unit with a clock and a lamp attached. We put it down on our porch, and my aunt sat in it, tossing her highlighted blonde hair over her shoulder. There was a low hum all around the room as she sat down, and when she opened her mouth, she muttered a string of obscenities. I opened my eyes to see a drool thread suspended between my lip and my sweatshirt. I wiped away the drool and nearly jumped out of my seat when I looked to my left to see the woman sitting there next to me, cursing at her broken cell phone and twisting a strand of brown hair around her finger. "When did you get here?" I asked. "Like 10 minutes ago," she said, not looking up. "You snore like a motherfucker." "Sorry," I said, and felt my cheeks go red. "Did hitchhiking not work out?" I asked. She didn't hear me. "Hey, do you know anything about phones?" she asked. "I found this one in Toledo, but I think it died. I can't get it to turn back on." She handed it to me. I flipped it open, hit the red power button, and the screen blinked to life. I handed it back. "How did you do that?" she said. "Magic," I told her. "You're a real pal," she said. "Now let's get out of here." She stood up and pulled at my sleeve, but I resisted. The bus rumbled to life again, and in minutes, we were on our way. "I guess that works," she said. 20 minutes later, we were on the outskirts of Gary, its smell preceding the city itself by miles. The land looked ravaged by the remnants of industrialism. Human activity had permanently changed the place, but there weren't any humans left as far as I could see. We stopped at the Gary bus terminal, and the driver left without a word. Usually they clue everyone in as to how long we'll be stopped and if it's all right to get off the bus. We waited for a few minutes, and then she took the initiative to get out, rushing into the glass doors of the bus station. I hesitated, waiting to see if others would follow. My bladder was achingly full, so I grabbed my bag and ran to the restroom. I rushed back as soon as I could, pushed through the main doors, and watched my bus turn the corner out of the station. I felt myself gasp and ran for it. I'm not exactly in shape and fell far short. And suddenly, I was alone and anonymous in Gary, the ass crack of the Midwest. I sucked in air that wouldn't get past my throat. I ran into the customer service desk to figure something out, and was met by a squat bureaucrat of a woman who, without so much as making eye contact, informed me that the soonest I could leave was midnight, 4 hours from then, to get on a bus that would bring me to Minneapolis 2 hours after the funeral, and I would have to pay $50 for a new ticket. No refunds. Shit. I headed back out to the platform. A younger version of myself would have cried. I tried to, but nothing would come, just a hot, dry sting in my eyes. I sat down on the curb, staring into the station's parking lot. I was more alone than most people my age ever cared to be. I thought of the people I'd met so far in college, who, in the few weeks I'd been there, didn't seem capable of spending time alone. So maybe my comfort with being solitary made me stand out. Or maybe I was just kidding myself, as all I could think about was my desire to be with them, joke with them, be exhilarated by new friends. In that moment of my late teenage angst, she walked outside, chomping bites off a chocolate bar and fiddling with her once again broken phone. I gave her a small wave, which she didn't see, then a bigger one that she did. "Hey, where's our bus?" I told her it was gone, that we were stuck there. It felt good to say we. "Shit, that sucks," she said, still chewing the chocolate and nougat. I asked if all her stuff was still on the bus. She nodded and shrugged and said she'd get it eventually. She sat next to me on the curb. It baffled me how calm she acted. "Wait, where are we?" she asked. I told her Gary, Indiana. "I know a guy in Gary," she said, and asked for my phone to see if she could get a hold of him. I handed it over and listened as she stood up and paced around with it, calling a few wrong numbers from a list scribbled on a crumpled piece of paper before getting her guy, who seemed friendly enough based on her half of the conversation. She came back to the curb. I asked her if she had any news. She said this guy Matt could pick us up in an hour and get us to Chicago tonight if we could get him a few bucks for gas. It was better than nothing. "In the meantime," she said, opening her purse and revealing a tightly rolled joint, "let's chill for a bit." I asked what was in it, and she said just weed. "It won't hurt you, come on." "Why'd you leave?" I asked. After a few hits, time wasn't an issue anymore, and I laughed at everything she said. "'Cause I fucking hated him," she said, ashing the joint against the curb. "Haven't you ever hated someone so much you just have to get the fuck away from them forever?" I said no, I hadn't. Which was true, I couldn't think of anyone I'd known that I truly hated. I'd hated a few politicians and celebrities, or at least hated the idea of them, but I never hated anyone. I never truly loved someone either, I thought. And I told her that for some reason. She laughed a bit, then apologized. "How old did you say you were?" she asked. 18, I told her. "Shit," she laughed. I looked up at her. Her wide eyes looked slimmer now, her features softer, and I felt myself grow warm as she gave me a calm smile. I was leaning in towards her, and she towards me. The buzz in my head moved down to my chest and my heart felt swollen as it pumped too fast. I breathed in, but the air stuck in the inflamed lining of my throat and sent back a dry, hacking cough. She laughed and turned away. I blushed, moving back to my spot and looked at the parking lot. I realized I didn't even know her name and turned back to ask. That's when she disappeared.
I wish I had a beach house.
beginning of Crisis in September, one of the stories in my Division 3. And if you want to hear the rest of that story on future episodes of the show, please let me know by emailing me at napshow, that's N-A-P-S-H-O-W, at gmail.com. Well, I haven't found my destination out here yet, but I guess that's the point of wandering through the woods. I'm getting a little bit cold, though, and I'm not totally sure where I am. So I think I'm going to go turn around and head back home. Yeah. The best kind of wandering is the kind where you can go have hot chocolate afterwards. Yeah, it sounds really good. All right. Well, thanks for listening to the show, everyone. And remember to like North American Psychotherapy on Facebook or check out the occasionally updated blog at napshow.wordpress.com. Okay. Whew. I'll talk to you next week. Keep wandering. But as always, stay sane. Good night.
I rolled and I tumbled. right. That was Bob Dylan with Rollin' and Tumblin', a new Bob Dylan song, or relatively new. So yeah, that was the produced part of the show. So thank you for listening. It was enjoyable to do and put together. And I'm wondering what you thought. If you want to call in, that is an option right now. The number here at the Yurt is 413-559-6766. And if you listen to the produced part of the show and, and if you want to call in, that's the number, 413-559-6766. We can talk about that. We can talk about whatever you want. Let's see. What else is going on? Super Tuesday. It is the superest of Tuesdays. In every 4 years, you know, we get to have a super time. So the results so far, if you haven't been checking, Georgia is going to Newt Gingrich. He's got 43% right now. Vermont right now is looking like it's going to Romney, although earlier it was looking like it was going to Ron Paul. Romney? Whatever. And Virginia looks like it's going to Romney with 56% and 44% for Ron Paul. Sorry, my friend Andrew is messaging me things. I do have a prospective student here. Do you want to go on the mic?
Sure. Do I just go on the
mic? Yeah. Here you go. This is Brendan McPherson. He's he's touring Hampshire tonight, or staying in Hampshire. How do you like it so far?
So far, so good.
Okay, cool. Someone is suggesting that people call in to suggest nicknames for you.
For me?
Yeah. How do you feel about that?
I'm okay with that. Sounds like fun.
Okay, well, the number is 413-559-6766. If you want to do that. Or we could talk about Super Tuesday, too. Whatever you feel like. Or you know, the show, but whatever, guys. I guess in the meantime, I can play some music or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I wonder if this phone actually is working. The only way to know is if people call in. So
it's up to you.
Yeah, it's up to you, people. Come on. In the meantime, here's local natives.
Time.
Looking something up here. I'm letting a prospective student take over the yurt right now, or not take it over, but play a song. So, Hampshire College, the future is coming, and you can't stop it. Some, you know, new people are going to show up, and they're just going to keep showing up, and everyone else is just going to keep getting older and going away, and then more new people. Etc. Etc. That sounds really sad. It's, you know, it's not that bad.
It's not nearly as depressing as it makes it sound.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good. We're all good. All right. So what are we gonna listen to?
We're gonna listen to "Bury You Alive" by a band called The Daredevil Christopher Wright off their album "In Deference to a Broken Back." So I hope you enjoy it. Potential future Hampshire friends / classmates, kind of, I guess, unless you graduate. Yeah. So. Here goes.
All right.